Thank you, Brother Joe and Brother Richard, for your opening prayer. Everyone likes to hear a good story well told. We Bible students especially appreciate the lessons taught in the scriptural accounts of characters in the Old and New Testaments. These accounts are stories, not in the sense that they are fables, but in the sense that they are true histories of the lives of those Bible characters. And so I call them Bible stories in that sense of the word. What's your favorite Bible story? If a child came to you and said, "Tell me a Bible story," which one would be the first to come to your mind? Would it be the bravery of David when he faced Goliath? Or the wisdom and courage of Esther as she saved her people at the risk of her own life? Perhaps the love story of Mary, who anointed the feet of Jesus. There are too many favorites to have just one, I suppose. So the best we can do is have a list of 10 or 20 or 30 of our favorite Bible stories. On my list, fairly near the top, would be a story that might not even be on your list at all. You know which it is from my title. The story of Naaman the leper, sometimes referred to as the story of Naaman the Syrian. Today I'll tell you the story of Naaman the leper, first in the brief form as you would tell it to a child. Then we'll read the account verse by verse in 2 Kings chapter 5 and examine the details of the story. There won't be any pictures on the screen today, because while illustrations are useful with a discourse on a technical subject, they can be a little distracting in a talk like this, where the pictures in your imagination are the most helpful in bringing the lessons to your minds. On a very basic level, the story of Naaman the leper would be told to a child like this. Naaman was a mighty general in the army of Syria, and he had leprosy, a disease that rots away your flesh and ultimately kills you. It's very contagious, so that no one dares to even touch anyone who has leprosy. The king of Syria sent his friend Naaman to Israel to see if the prophet Elisha could cure Naaman the leper and save his life. Naaman came to Elisha and was told to wash himself 7 times in the river Jordan. Naaman did as Elisha told him, and his leprosy was healed. There are 2 lessons in this story, we would tell the child. The first is a lesson of faith. Naaman had faith in God, and his faith was rewarded. We should have a strong faith like Naaman's. The second lesson is a symbolic lesson about the kingdom. In this symbolic lesson, Naaman pictures the world of mankind, and Naaman's leprosy pictures the disease of sin and death that afflicts all mankind. And when Naaman bathed in the river Jordan and his leprosy was healed, that pictured how in the kingdom all mankind will be resurrected and healed from their sin and death. That's the simple story of Naaman the leper and the 2 basic lessons. Now let's take a much closer look at the details of the account. In the business world, there's an expression, "the devil is in the details," meaning that sometimes the little things are the hardest to resolve and to get right. But in Bible stories, I like to say, the beauty is in the details. The richness of the lessons is in the details. And we'll find that's true in the story of Naaman the leper, which is told in 2 Kings chapter 5. If you'd like to turn to that, we're going to read the entire chapter a few verses at a time, and we'll only leave 2 Kings chapter 5 twice to look at a few other scriptures. Let's begin with 2 Kings chapter 5, verse 1. Now Naaman, captain of the host of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master, and honorable, because by him the Lord had given deliverance unto Syria. He was also a mighty man in valor, but he was a leper. This verse tells us four things about Naaman. First, he was the captain of all the armies of Syria, their general, their commander-in-chief, and he was a brave leader, a mighty man of valor. Second, he was loved and highly respected by the king of Syria. Third, Jehovah God gave Naaman a victory over Syria's enemies because Naaman was an honorable man, a good man. Fourth, he had leprosy. Leprosy was a terrible disease. It manifested itself as whitish sores on the face and ultimately all over the body. The nerve endings close to the skin were attacked and deadened so that all movement and feeling were lost in the hands and feet and the arms and the legs. It was common for lepers to injure themselves and not even realize that they had been wounded. The disease was contagious and always resulted in a premature death. That's why leprosy is a fitting symbol of sin, which also results in a deadening of the moral senses, self-injury, and leads to death. I said leprosy was a terrible disease. Leprosy is now called Hansen's disease because the bacterium which causes leprosy was identified by a Norwegian doctor named G. Armauer Hansen. And today there are antibiotics which can completely control the disease. Oh, and the year in which Dr. Hansen discovered this bacterium, which ultimately led to the cure for leprosy, was the year 1874. Now let's read verses 2-4 of 2 Kings 5. And the Syrians had gone out by companies and had brought away captive out of the land of Israel a little maid, and she waited on Naaman's wife. And she, that is this little maid, said unto her mistress, Would God my lord, that's Naaman, were with the prophet that is in Samaria, for he would recover him out of his leprosy. And one went in and told his lord, saying, Thus and thus said the maid that is of the land of Israel. These are, to my mind, some of the most interesting verses in the entire account because they quickly introduce and then just as quickly remove the most fascinating character in the whole story. Not Naaman, not even Elisha, but a young woman whose name is not given. I almost entitled this discourse, The Little Maid, because she is the real heroine. As much as, or even more so, than Naaman himself. I'll explain why in a moment. But first, picture in your mind, use your imaginations, as I said before, a movie about the story of Naaman the leper. The movie portrays raids by small bands of Syrian soldiers upon the outlying farms and villages of Israel. The marauding Syrians sneak up on their victims, steal their food, and take the people captive back to Damascus, the capital of Syria, to work as slaves. Among these captives on one of these raids is a little maid, a teenage girl. She shows some intelligence and talent, so she is given the better job of waiting on Naaman's wife, fetching water, helping her dress, running errands, and so forth. And, we can surmise, she was probably treated kindly in the house of Naaman because Naaman was a good man. Now, most teenage girls taken away from their homes and families to work as a servant girl in a strange land, even if they were treated kindly, as we can surmise, would, you expect, be rather sullen and bitter at their lot in life. And upon finding out that the master of the house had this dread disease of leprosy, most teenage girls would probably secretly be gleeful. Most teenage girls would think quietly to themselves, Good, I hope the disease ravishes you and you die. But this little maid, whose name is not given, was not like most teenage girls. She was sensitive to Naaman's plight and said to his wife, her mistress, "If only your husband were in my home country, where we worship the true God, there is a prophet there who would cure him of his leprosy." What maturity, what empathy from this young woman. But that's not at all why I think the little maid is the real heroine of the story. Not for her maturity or her empathy. The reason I think the little maid is the real heroine of this story is because it was the shining example of her faith in God that created faith in Naaman. Naaman was an experienced man, a world traveler. He was not one to believe fairy tales taught by immature children. Yet it was on the urgent word of this teenage girl that Naaman took the long journey to Israel in faith and confidence in the God of that country, and he was cured. The lesson of the story, as I said before, is to have faith like Naaman's. But what fiery faith the little maid must have shown to kindle the faith of Naaman. If your faith is like Naaman's, good. But if your faith is like the little maid's, bringing forth in others a similar faith, better. And the faith of the little maid is all the more remarkable when we realize that Elisha had never to that date cured anyone of leprosy. How could the little maid be so confident in something she had never seen happen? We'll talk more about that later. But the point is, may the witness of your faith be not only like that of Naaman's, but even more like that of the little maid. Let's continue on with the Bible account in 2 Kings 5, 5 to 8. 2 Kings 5, 5 to 8. And the king of Syria said, "Go to, go, and I will send a letter unto the king of Israel." And he, Naaman, departed, and took with him 10 talents of silver, and 6,000 pieces of gold, and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, "Now when this letter is come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman my servant to thee, that thou mayest recover him of his leprosy." And it came to pass, when the king of Israel had read the letter, that, and this probably happened in private, out of Naaman's hearing, he rent his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and make alive, that this man doth send unto me to recover a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, how he seeketh a quarrel against me." And it was so, when Elisha, the man of God, had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, "Wherefore hast thou rent thy clothes? Let him, Naaman, come now to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." Now, in Old Testament times, matters such as this were managed at the highest levels, at the levels of the heads of state. And so the king of Syria, who, as we said before, loved and respected Naaman, sent a formal request in writing with him to the king of Israel, along with gifts of gold, silver, and raiment, and asked respectfully for the king of Israel to arrange for the healing of Naaman of his leprosy. The king of Syria no doubt reasoned that such a man who could cure leprosy would be well known to the king of Israel, probably even a member of the king's inner circle of ministers and advisors. Well, the king of Syria guessed wrong. And, as we read, the king of Israel responded badly. First of all, the king of Israel is unaware or else cannot figure out that it is Elisha the prophet whose services are being requested. Apparently, the king of Israel thought he himself was expected to cure Naaman's leprosy. Second, the king of Israel misinterprets the request by the king of Syria as being a pretense to declare war, when the king of Israel would be forced to refuse this impossible request to heal Naaman. And so the king of Israel excuses himself from Naaman's presence and hastily calls together his advisors for a private meeting, where he rends his clothes in a sign of extreme anguish, What should he do? He asks his counselors. You see the dilemma I'm in. Let me digress for a moment from the account of 2 Kings 5 to give you a little interesting history about who this king of Israel was and what his prior dealings with Elisha were. After Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind, Elisha assumed the role of prophet. Ahab and Jezebel were dead, and we pick up the history in 2 Kings chapter 3. Turn back just two chapters in your Bible to 2 Kings chapter 3, and we'll read verses 1 through 3. 2 Kings 3, 1 to 3. Now Jehoram, the son of Ahab, began to reign over Israel in Samaria in the 18th year of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, and reigned 12 years. And he wrought evil in the sight of the Lord, but not like his father and like his mother, for he put away the image of Baal that his father had made. Nevertheless, he cleaved unto the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which made Israel to sin. He departed not therefrom, that is, from the sins of Jeroboam. So the king of Israel, whose name is not given in 2 Kings 5, is most likely this Jehoram, son of Ahab, in 2 Kings 3. Now Jehoram was a wicked, evil king, as we read, although he was slightly better than his father Ahab, in that Jehoram tore down the statue of Baal, which his father Ahab had made. But Jehoram continued in the sins of Jeroboam, who, if you recall, back in Solomon's time, caused the division of Israel into the two-tribe kingdom of Judah and the ten-tribe kingdom of Israel. And Jeroboam's sins were that he erected golden calves for the people to worship, and he made priests of the lowest, most unfit of the people of Israel. So Jehoram was no reformer in that he continued in those same sins of idolatry and an unfit priesthood. And he was not much better than his wicked father Ahab. Staying in 2 Kings chapter 3 for a moment, I'll summarize verses 4 through 9 so I can get to the good part about Elisha and Jehoram in verses 10 through 14. In verses 4 through 9, very briefly, it tells how there were three kings allied with each other: Jehoram, the king of Israel, Jehoshaphat, a good king of the two-tribe kingdom of Judah, and thirdly, the king of Edom. Arrayed against these three kings who were allied together was the king of Moab. And Jehoram makes a plea to Jehoshaphat for help against this threat from the king of Moab. And now let's pick up the account in 2 Kings chapter 3, 10 to 14. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, "Alas, that the Lord hath called these three kings together," that's us, "to deliver them into the hand of Moab," this fourth other king who was going to wage war with them. But Jehoshaphat, he's the good king of the two-tribe kingdom of Judah, said, "Is there not here a prophet of the Lord, that we may inquire of the Lord by him?" And one of the king of Israel's servants answered and said, "Here is Elisha, the son of Shaphat, which poured water on the hands of Elijah." Now notice, it's not Jehoram who answers quickly, "Yes, I know, there's Elisha, he lives in my country." But it's one of his servants who recognizes whom Jehoshaphat is asking about. And Jehoshaphat said, "The word of the Lord is with him," with Elisha. So the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat the king and the king of Edom went down to him, to Elisha. Here's where it gets good. And Elisha said unto the king of Israel, "What have I to do with thee? Get thee to the prophets of thy father and to the prophets of thy mother." And the king of Israel said unto him, "Nay, for the Lord hath called these three kings together to deliver them into the hand of Moab." In other words, don't reject our plea. We're in trouble here. Help us. And Elisha said, As the Lord of hosts liveth, before whom I stand, surely were it not that I regard the presence of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look toward thee, nor see thee. What a rebuke. If it weren't for good King Jehoshaphat being here with you, I wouldn't even look at you, Jehoram. And of course, Elisha had several reasons to have little esteem for Jehoram. First, as we read, Jehoram was an evil king. He did not urge the people to put away their idols and instead worship only Jehovah and keep his commandments. And second, on a more personal level, Jehoram was the son of Ahab and Jezebel, who had persecuted and tormented Elisha's friend and mentor, Elijah. So that's a little background about what has gone on before between Elisha and Jehoram. So now let's return to the account in 2 Kings 5. Elisha was told all of what happened when Naaman presented himself to Jehoram and how Jehoram reacted and what he said and that he rent his clothes. So Elisha sends a messenger back to the king, Jehoram, to calm him down and reassure him. "Why did you rend your clothes? Send Naaman to me," Elisha tells Jehoram through his messenger, "and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel." And I may be reading perhaps a little bit of unfounded sarcasm into Elisha's message here, but I think Elisha's implication was, "And you too, O king of Israel, you also will know that there is a prophet in Israel right here in your backyard." Doubtless, King Jehoram was greatly relieved to have this dilemma off of his hands, to be able to pass the buck to Elisha. So he regains his kingly composure. He returns to Naaman, obviously after putting on some new clothes, with instructions to go see Elisha, who will take care of Naaman's request. The story continues in 2 Kings 5, verses 9 through 14. So Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot and stood at the door of the house of Elisha. And Elisha sent a messenger unto him, saying, "Go and wash in Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall come again to thee, and thou shalt be clean." But Naaman was wroth and went away and said, "Behold, I thought he will surely come out to me and stand and call on the name of the Lord his God and strike his hand over the place and recover the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? May I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. And his servants came near and spake unto him and said, "My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? How much rather then when he saith to thee, wash and be clean?" Then he went down and dipped himself 7 times in Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, and his flesh came again, like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. If the little maid is the most fascinating character in this story, and I think she is, I think these verses are the most moving. I hope that when the movie version of this account is finally made in the kingdom, I get to help write the screenplay. Naaman comes to Elisha's house, probably a humble dwelling, far less than what Naaman was expecting for a powerful, holy man who could cure leprosy. Naaman stands patiently outside the door and waits for the great Elisha to receive him. Presently, Elisha's assistant, probably Gehazi, we'll hear more about him later, comes to the door with instructions for Naaman: "Go to the Jordan River and wash or submerge yourself 7 times, and your leprosy will be healed." Elisha doesn't even come to the door to say hello. Now it's Naaman who reacts curiously. He's angry. Naaman is angry for 2 reasons. First, he says, "I expected Elisha to come out here and stand before me and put on a show, I expected him to call upon his God and wave his hands around the place and say the magic words, and Shazam, I would be healed from my leprosy. Back home in Syria, Naaman probably saw many such showy displays by the false prophets of his god Rimmon. Doubtless the priests of Rimmon had prayed to their false god on Naaman's behalf many times that his leprosy might be healed, all to no avail. So Naaman probably thought, this is how all religious men do their work, with a great show, in order to impress the people. Second, the second reason why Naaman was angry, he says in verse 12, why should I wash in the Jordan Creek? To Naaman, the Jordan River was just a little creek. There are much larger and mightier rivers back where I came from, much more fitting to be the setting for this great miracle of healing. So Naaman turns around and walks away in a rage. Now it's important to note, his faith was still strong. Naaman's faith here was not in question, but he's greatly displeased. It seems that almost all the great heroes of the Old Testament have a flaw. Abraham lied twice about Sarah being his wife. Moses smote the rock the second time instead of speaking to it, and so was denied entrance into the promised land. David yielded to lust for Bathsheba. Because the scriptures include the accounts of even these flaws, we know the Bible is a true record of God's word and not mere fables about impossibly perfect people with no flaws devised by conniving men. And there is always a lesson for us in these flaws of the Bible heroes. What do you suppose is a lesson for us in this flaw of Naaman's? Perhaps it is this. At the beginning of the gospel of the harvest of the gospel age, Christians coming out of the nominal church systems into the truth were like Naaman coming out of Syria to Israel and Elisha. Like Naaman, Christians in the nominal churches were accustomed to worship services being a great show with ornate buildings and costumes and elaborate ceremonies. A great show, like Naaman had seen in the house of Rimmon. So perhaps, a few, not many we think, of those coming out of Babylon in the early days of the gospel harvest were a little put off by the lack of the ceremony and the pomp that they had become accustomed to in the meetings of the brethren. They expected to see the same show that they were used to, instead of the simplicity of the true worship of Jehovah. God's instructions to all Christians, like Elisha's instructions to Naaman, were simple but effective in cleansing them from sin. Worship God in spirit and in truth. Believe in the ransom merit of Jesus' blood and consecrate yourself to sacrifice. Simple but effective. Today, at this end of the gospel age harvest, that lack of show and ceremony would not stumble any of us who are several generations removed from the nominal churches. But I think there is still a similar lesson, even for us here and now, in Naaman's anger. Naaman complained that his expectations were not being satisfied by the instructions he was given. The style of the worship services and the arrangement for his healing from leprosy were not meeting his needs. Or so Naaman thought. In fact, everything was arranged to meet Naaman's needs. Naaman confused his needs with his wants. He needed to be healed from leprosy, but he wanted his healing done in a manner according to his liking, according to his preference. And isn't it so sometimes with us? What we truly need is to be cleansed, justified, sanctified, developed into a Christ-like character. Sometimes we want our character development to be done in a manner according to our liking, at our jobs, in our homes, with our ecclesia, in our lives. Again, our faith is always still strong. Our faith is not in question. But sometimes we are rather displeased, like Naaman was, with our experiences, with our situation. And we might come this close, as Naaman did, to turning around and walking away from our experiences. If not in a rage, at least in self-willed stubbornness from the circumstances God has arranged for us. Fortunately for Naaman, he listened to those around him who loved him. They were his servants, but they addressed him as father in verse 13. My father, if the prophet had bid thee do some great thing, wouldst thou not have done it? In other words, if Elisha came to you and told you to walk 100 miles through the hot desert, naked, with no food and only a little water, and then to climb to the top of a rocky, jagged mountain and sit there for 7 days, and then build a stone altar 10 feet tall all by yourself and offer a sacrifice, and then your leprosy would be healed, wouldn't you have done it? Naaman knew the answer was yes. And so the logic of the servants was compelling. How reasonable it would be to do the simple thing that Elisha had directed and wash in the Jordan 7 times. The lesson again for us, brethren, is that submissiveness to God's will and not insisting on our own preferences is essential to our sanctification. Not my will, but thy will, O Lord, be done. How wise are God's commands, how sure his precepts are, as we sang in our opening hymn. Now comes the best part of the whole story. And in the movie version I like to picture in my mind, you see a silent procession travel to the bank of the River Jordan. Naaman, calm now, his faith still as strong as it always has been, takes off his garments and slowly wades into the river by himself, the water up to his chest. His servants, unsure of what will happen, watch with some anxiety as Naaman lowers himself into the water. He rises up, and his servants strain to see any improvement in the scars on his face and arms, but there is none. A second time, Naaman immerses himself and rises up out of the water. Still no improvement in his leprosy. Again, the third, fourth, fifth, and sixth time with the same result. This isn't working. The leprosy is not being healed. The servants glance nervously at each other as Naaman pauses for a moment and then lowers himself the seventh and last time. He seems to be beneath the water for a long time. But then the top of his head appears above the surface. Next, his face and shoulders completely clean of the dread disease, his flesh like that of a little child. Naaman looks at his hands and his arms, beaming. The servants cannot contain themselves. They run, shouting and splashing into the river, and throw themselves on Naaman, embracing him and kissing him, almost knocking him over in their joy. After a few moments, Naaman pushes them gently away and with a look of resolve on his face softly says, "We must return to Elisha." In my little dramatization there, I said that the first 6 washings had no effect on Naaman's leprosy and that the 7th removed all of it. The scriptures don't say it happened that way, but I think such is a reasonable conclusion from the kingdom picture I mentioned before, which is the symbolic lesson of this whole story. Naaman's leprosy pictures mankind's disease of sin and death, which will be cleansed in the kingdom, cleansed entirely within the 7,000-year day after 6,000 years of no improvement from the curse of sin and death. The account continues in 2 Kings 5:15 to 19. And he returned to the man of God, he and all his company, and came and stood before him and said, "Behold, now I know that there is no God in all the earth but in Israel. Now therefore I pray thee, take a blessing of thy servant." But he, Elijah, said, "As the Lord liveth before whom I stand, I will receive none." And he, Naaman, urged him to take it, but Elisha refused. And Naaman said, "Shall there not then, I pray thee, be given to thy servant, me, Naaman, 2 mules burden of earth? For thy servant will henceforth offer neither burnt offering nor sacrifice unto other gods, but unto the Lord. In this thing the Lord pardon thy servant, that when my master goeth into the house of Rimmon to worship there, he leaneth on my hand, and I bow myself in the house of Rimmon. When I bowed down myself in the house of Rimmon, the Lord pardoned thy servant in this thing." And he, Elisha, said unto him, Naaman, "Go in peace." So he departed from him a little way. Naaman offers Elisha the silver and gold and raiment he had brought with him as payment for his healing. Again, such payment to priests and prophets was probably the custom in Naaman's homeland of Syria. And following our application earlier, payment to priests for prayers and other favors was and still is the custom in the nominal churches. Elisha, of course, refuses all of Naaman's repeated urgent offers of payment, just as we minister the cleansing truth of God's plan to all who will receive it without any material reimbursement. And then Naaman asks Elisha if Naaman could take back to Syria as much dirt from Elisha's yard as 2 mules could carry. Naaman wants to bring back to his homeland enough of the soil of Israel to spread in Naaman's own yard for a holy place to worship the true God. And he vows to Elisha that henceforth Naaman will worship only Jehovah. What is the lesson for us? Don't we also carry in our hearts, not earth, but the memories of times and places where God led us and blessed us? Don't we also have special places in our hearts, little altars of remembrance where we go to praise and pray, where we go to reflect and be refreshed? Verse 18 of 2 Kings 5 is particularly meaningful. Again, in the movie that plays in my mind, I see Naaman with his entourage ready to depart, the mules loaded down with the soil of Israel. Naaman has said his goodbyes. He's got 1 foot out the door. And then he turns back to Elisha with a troubled look on his face. There's something that's been bothering him, and he's not sure if he should even bring it up. But he does. Elisha, there's one more thing. I now know there is but one God, Jehovah, and I will worship only him. But when my king goes into the temple of Rimmon to pray, he's old, and he takes my arm for support because we're such good friends. I go with him all the time. And when the king bows down before Rimmon, I cannot remain standing upright. If I don't also bow myself when the king bows, it would be disrespectful to my king. And so I would like to bow myself in the house of Rimmon when the king bows. In my heart, I'm not bowing to Rimmon, but rather I'm bowing in respect to my friend, the king. "Would that be okay?" Naaman asks. "Could I be pardoned for this?" In the mental picture I have of this scene of what Naaman is describing, it's a flashback to earlier times in Damascus, the capital of Syria, where we see a huge, magnificent temple to Rimmon with a large marble staircase up to the gold-gilded sanctuary where the statue of Rimmon stands. The king, somewhat old but still majestic, climbs the stairs slowly with his friend Naaman at his side. Naaman, his arm covered with clothes to prevent the spread of his leprosy, supports the king as he ascends the stairs. And they bow in unison as they enter, they bow as they pray, and they bow as they leave. But that was then, before Naaman was healed. This is now. What should Naaman do? He knows that it's wrong to bow down before the false god Rimmon anymore, but he doesn't want to offend his friend the king. Elisha tells Naaman, "It's all right. Continue to do as you have done for your friend the king's sake. Be at peace in your heart about this." What's the lesson for us in this exchange between Naaman and Elisha? Perhaps it's this, but you judge for yourselves. In my own experience, about every 5 or 10 years or so, I find myself sitting in the back of a Catholic church for the wedding of one of my cousin's children or the funeral of one of my aunts and uncles. And I feel uncomfortable being there. When everyone else does the standing and the kneeling and the repeating of the words, it gives me the heebie-jeebies. And sometimes I even wonder if I'm doing the wrong thing just sitting there in that building. And I know some perhaps of you have similar discomfort about that or about even being in a building like this with all of the Masons' trappings and symbols. Perhaps the message for us in Elisha's reply to Naaman is that if your heart is pure, as Naaman's was, your presence, even in an unholy place, will not corrupt you. If, for the sake of others, you find it reasonably necessary to be there so as not to offend them, then, as Elisha said to Naaman, go in peace. And so Naaman departs for home. The story continues with a lesson about Elisha's servant Gehazi. But first I want to turn to one and the only one scripture in the entire New Testament about Naaman. And then we'll come back to 2 Kings 5. In Luke chapter 4 is the account of Jesus, after having performed miracles of healing in Capernaum, comes to Nazareth, his home, so to speak, and the people of Nazareth say to him, "How about us? We're your neighbors. Perform miracles and healings for us, like you did for those strangers out there in Capernaum." Jesus answers this request for favors in Luke 4, 24 to 28. Luke 4, 24 to 28. "And he," that's Jesus, "said, 'Verily I say unto you, no prophet is accepted in his own country. But I tell you of a truth, many widows were in Israel in the days of Elijah," it says Elias, but that's Elijah, "when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months, when great famine was throughout all the land. But unto none of them was Elijah sent, save unto Sarepta, a city of Sidon, unto a woman that was a widow. And many lepers were in Israel in the time of Elisha, the prophet, and none of them was cleansed, saving Naaman the Syrian. And all they," these now are the residents of Nazareth, his hometown people, "all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath." Jesus' point was, if there are none with faith to be found where there ought to be, God will find those of faith elsewhere. So it was in Elisha's day. There were many Hebrew lepers in Israel, but he healed none of them. Why? Because they kept not the law and the faith of their fathers. Only Naaman, a heathen who knew not Jehovah until the word of the little maid came to him, was cured. Likewise, the Jews in Jesus' day, according to this account, said proudly, "We are Abraham's seed. We are a nation of God's chosen people. For that reason alone, we are entitled to receive his blessings." But Jesus reminded them, as Elisha did in his day, that simple collective heritage as God's people is not enough, and God's blessings passed them by. Each must make his faith his own, individually, and live his faith daily. So it is with us. We have a Bible student heritage of truth that is wonderful indeed. But it is not enough to say, "I have the truth of the harvest message. I am a consecrated son of God. I meet with an ecclesia of Bible students." We must, likewise, individually, make that faith our own by continual study in the doctrines and truths and to live it daily, or God's blessings will pass us by. I said before that the faith of the little maid in Elisha that he could cure Naaman's leprosy was remarkable because Elisha had never before healed a leper. And that was verified by what we just read in Luke 4. Naaman was the first and only leper Elisha healed. So how could the little maid be so sure Elisha could do that? How could she tell Naaman with such confidence that Elisha would cure him? I think the answer is that the little maid most likely had seen or else heard of Elisha's other miracles. And so it was on that basis of what she had seen that gave her the faith that Elisha could do what she had not seen. And so it should be with us. Our faith in God's care over us is strengthened when we think of all his past favors and providences for ourselves and others. And we trust him for all our present and future care, even where we have not seen or cannot see what might come upon us. Such was the faith of the little maid, and such should our faith be. Now let's return to the end of the story of Naaman in 2 Kings chapter 5. The last part of verse 19 says, Naaman departed from Elisha a little way. Let's read verses 20 through the end of the chapter, verse 27. But Gehazi, the servant of Elisha, the man of God, said, Behold, my master hath spared Naaman this Syrian in not receiving at his hands that which he brought. But as the Lord liveth, I will run after him and take somewhat of him. So Gehazi followed after Naaman. And when Naaman saw him running after him, he lighted down from the chariot to meet him and said, Is all well? And he said, All is well. My master hath sent me, saying, Behold, even now there be come to me from Mount Ephraim two young men of the sons of the prophets. Give them, I pray thee, a talent of silver and two changes of garments. And Naaman said, Be content, take two talents. And he urged him and bound two talents of silver in two bags with two changes of garments and laid them upon two of his servants, and they bare them before him. And when he came to the tower, he took them from their hand and bestowed them in the house, and he let the men go, and they departed. But he, that is Gehazi, went in and stood before his master. And Elisha said unto him, Whence comest thou, Gehazi? And he said, Thy servant went no whither. And he said unto him, Went not mine heart with thee when the man turned again from his chariot to meet thee? Is it a time to receive money and to receive garments and olive yards and vineyards and sheep and oxen and men servants and maid servants? The leprosy therefore of Naaman shall cleave unto thee and unto thy seed forever. And he went out from his presence a leper, as white as snow. One of the details that caught my eye was in verse 21, where it says, Naaman lighted down or got off his chariot to meet the running Gehazi and asks urgently, Is all well? Normally an important man like Naaman would wait, standing high and proud in his chariot, until the lowly servant approached to deliver the message. But Naaman was humble and got down to meet Gehazi, concerned that the running messenger was bringing bad news of some misfortune that had just befallen Elisha and he needed help. Humility and concern for the welfare of one with whom he had bonded in the worship of the true God was another good character quality of Naaman. Gehazi, of course, did not have the spirit of Elisha, and he schemed to take advantage of Naaman's offer of payment, which Elisha had previously and firmly declined. Generous Naaman gives Gehazi even more than Gehazi requested, and even provides two of his servants to carry the silver and clothes back for him. Gehazi hides the goods in the house and goes in to Elisha. I picture in my mind Elisha sitting at his table, deep in thought, and without even looking up, asks Gehazi, Where have you been? Gehazi replies, Nowhere. Reminds me of conversations I often had with my kids when they were teenagers. Where did you go? Nowhere. Where did you do? Nothing. Now Elisha looks up and fixes his gaze on the lying servant and tells him that he knows where he went and what he did. Elisha's rebuke in verse 26, I think, is particularly relevant to us. Is it a time to receive money and all this material gain? Note the very specific form of the question. Is it time? Brethren, the same question is put to us every day, and we know that the answer is now is not the time for us to receive material gain, but to sacrifice. There will be a time. That time will come at our spiritual birth, when we will receive riches beyond comparison. But that time is not yet. So let us touch lightly the things of this earth, as Elisha did, esteeming them only of trifling worth. Gehazi's punishment was that the leprosy from which Naaman was cleansed fell upon him and his house forever. This seems to be a picture of second death, forever. But when should we apply it? To the willful sinners among the consecrated in the gospel age, or to the incorrigible of mankind in the kingdom? All of Elisha's miracles, not just this healing of Naaman, but his other miracles as well, in general, are kingdom pictures. And that's how we have applied this healing of Naaman to the kingdom. But there are also in this account many lessons for us now, and we have brought those out as well. So I think to the answer to my question about the second death and when it applies in this story is that it applies primarily to the incorrigible of mankind in the kingdom, but also secondarily as a possibility now in the gospel age. And so the Bible account of the story of Naaman the leper ends. But the movie version that keeps running through my mind needs a happier ending. This last part about Gehazi is rather sad. I like happy endings. So while the scriptures don't tell us any more about what happened when Naaman got back to Damascus, maybe it ended like this. As Naaman approached the city, word quickly spread from the farmers in the outlying districts to the residents of Damascus that Naaman was on his way home and that he was cured of his leprosy. As he entered the gates, a throng pressed forward to greet him and then parted so he could be received by his friend the king, who was also awaiting Naaman's arrival. But the warmest embrace of all came from his wife, whose little maid had first told her of the prophet in Israel. And as for that little maid herself, I like to think that Naaman rewarded her by returning her to her homeland. Or perhaps even better, he gave her freedom and riches and even arranged for one of his sons to marry her so that Naaman's own grandchildren could be raised by their mother in the worship of the true God that Naaman himself now worshipped. Well, we don't really know how the story of Naaman the leper actually ended, but I suppose in the kingdom we'll find out. One thing we do know for sure, however, is that today, in our time, somewhere beneath the paved streets of modern-day Damascus, lies 2 mules' burden of earth, a few cubic yards of dirt, sacred ground, imported from Israel by one of Syria's greatest generals, who was a believer in Jehovah God, a picture of the kingdom, and an example of faith.
Thank you, Brother Joe, for revealing the beauty in the details of the cleansing of Naaman and how God appreciates the simple faith of his little ones. Brethren, we're going to close this meeting with the use of hymn 95, More Christ-like. We'll rise on the last verse, and Brother Joe will close this meeting with prayer. Number 95.